Thank you, everyone, for coming. We're also being joined today by the President of the United States, actually five of them, George Washington, John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, James Monroe. We'll also have access to the wisdom of Mr. Hamilton, the Treasury Secretary, Mr. Franklin, the Minister to France, Chief Justice Jay, Generals Green, von Steuben, Lafayette, and dozens of other founding fathers whose wisdom we will channel for you. Why are we here answering these questions? The main reason is that you ask them. You individually, you collectively. I mean, I've been giving talks on the founders for 10 years, and every single talk, whether it's a live talk or a radio show if it has call-ins, there is always at least one question: what would founder A do about X? And X can be an issue like the war in Iraq or the war on drugs, or it can be a person, President Bush, President Clinton. People want to know these reactions. And I don't think it's irrational. The founders are not that far away from us in time, certainly compared to other founders. Here's the way I think of it. When I was in college, I heard a talk by Alger Hiss. When Alger Hiss was a young man, he clerked for Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr. When Holmes was a captain in the Army, he told Abraham Lincoln, "Get down, you damn fool," when Lincoln stuck his head over a parapet of a Civil War battlefield that he was visiting. When Lincoln served his one term in Congress, one of the congressmen he served with was former President John Quincy Adams. And when John Quincy Adams was a boy, he heard the cannon and saw the smoke from the Battle of Bunker Hill from the Adams house in Braintree. So that's five steps from this room to the Revolution. And it's a lot further to Charlemagne or Alfred the Great or Ashoka or the founders of other countries. And finally, it's a lot of fun. So without further ado, what I'm going to spring on my fellow panelists, I brought the morning's newspaper, and the big picture is a Darfur refugee. This man is Adam Sharif, a Darfur refugee, listened yesterday in a camp in eastern Chad for news about peace talks taking place in Abuja, Nigeria. And the headline is, this is Mr. Sharif, the headline is, "Largest faction of Darfur rebels signs peace pact. 3 years of carnage, but two other groups reject accord posing possible threat to progress." Now, this is a story that's been going on for a number of years, the fighting and the slaughtering that's going on in Darfur. And many people have suggested that the United States do something about it, including Nicholas Kristof, who's one of the Times' op-ed columnists, has written a number of columns about it. Probably the two most important abstract discussions of foreign policy from the founders, I would nominate Washington's farewell address and the Monroe Doctrine. And maybe there are others that you think are equally pertinent. But what do my fellow historians think that the men of that generation, how would they react to such calls that we do something about this admittedly grave matter?
Well, I'd like to challenge your premises. And I'll
not allowed, but go ahead.
I'll let my fellow panelists deal with Darfur.
The founders were very gracious to the lady, so we will accept the challenge.
Five or six lifetimes is the distance between us and the founding fathers. And to answer how they would confront an issue is to not give them the experience that they would have had in those lifetimes, the challenges to their imagination The invitations to move beyond their prejudices, the surprise of unexpected developments that have confronted us all in a lifetime, those 5 or 6 lifetimes would have changed the founders in ways that we cannot possibly imagine. I think if we maybe put it in a simple way, is that if we think of our own lives, any of you who are over 50, there is some critical issue about which you have changed your mind in your lifetime. And you've also had friends who didn't change their mind in the same direction as you, and you couldn't have predicted how they would have responded. So those are the obstacles that I see to trying to figure out what the founders would have said or would have done or would have believed about an issue. Though I do agree with Rick, it's a lot of fun to try, and I think we'll have a lot of fun trying.
Well, but let me ask you a question. The founders read Plutarch. Why?
Why wouldn't they? I read Plutarch.
Well, but Plutarch is about the careers of politicians who were very remote from them, and they read Plutarch, I think, with a very practical sense. They wanted to see how these noble Greeks and Romans succeeded.
No.
They wanted to see how they.
No.
Shaking your head, but
well,
go ahead.
Of course,
tell me
of
why
course
not.
We're fascinated with past experience, and that's the way we expand on our lifetime. But Madison was at great pains to say that nothing, and Jefferson as well, that nothing that these Greek philosophers said could help them because they were in utterly new situation.
Steve, you want to jump in?
Well, it's not often that I can agree with you and disagree with Joyce. I mean, this is very unusual, but the founding fathers looked to history to understand human nature, and they learned certain things about human nature. They learned that human nature was unchangeable. They learned that there are certain qualities in human nature that are noble, but mainly they learned that there were certain qualities in human nature that were pretty base and that needed to be controlled. And they engaged in debates that illuminate our thought today. And one of the reasons we need to look at those debates about empire or about America's involvement in other places is because we have among the most intelligent Americans ever reflecting on those questions. And while they don't provide us with any clear-cut answers, they do provide us with perspectives that help us to illuminate our own thought. So the debate about whether the United States should serve as a moral model to emulate or whether it should engage in other countries directly, that was a debate that they were familiar with and rigorously debated about.
In your judgment or in all of your judgment, who would have been at all likely or most likely to say, well, yes, this is a terrible thing and we ought to take a leading role in rectifying it?
Thomas Jefferson's vision of an empire for liberty, which I'm afraid had some ambiguities because, of course, it was also an empire for slavery, suggested that the United States needed to help bring the life of the world elsewhere.
Thomas Jefferson is going to advise interfering in Darfur. Have you reflected on his attitudes toward another black disaster nearer our shores, like the Haitian Revolution? I'm sorry, I'm off this boat. But I'm with Joyce on this one. I mean, I think the limits on which we can any meaningful way take the founders as an inspiration for contemporary policies is very limited. I mean, these were Enlightenment figures. They made their conclusions on the basis of their experience. What they knew of British history, what they knew of their own history, the history they'd lived through. I mean, I go with my students in great detail over the changing conclusions with regard to governmental institutions between 1776 and 1789. Having gone through such immense changes within their lifetime, they had no difficulty imagining that future generations were also going to have very different experiences. And they had tremendous confidence that certainly John Adams did, and I believe Jefferson as well, from things he said in the 1820s, but particularly John Adams, that the younger generations would be able to adjust American institutions and American policy according to unanticipated events.
Well,
now,
one thing they invented was
you,
partisanship.
Though, I haven't read your book, but I did read the blurb.
That's all you need. You can review
how?
It, you know?
Sometimes we review it.
Here you go.
Sir,
you can
how
get started.
Can you talk about George Washington's views of gays in the military? I'm really interested to hear what you say about that.
Well, gay people today who look for a usable past, two of the people they turn to, as you know, are Baron von Steuben and also many of the young officers on Washington's staff, particularly Hamilton and John Lawrence. They get a lot of attention because of the letters they wrote to each other, which are certainly express a rapturous degree of friendship. Now, I myself think this is a rhetoric of sensibility, which was very popular at the time. Jane Austen wrote Sense and Sensibility in part to mock that rhetoric. So when Hamilton and Lawrence are writing to each other, you know, I love you, you have stolen my heart, it was very ill done that you did that, I tend to think that that's what's going on there. Baron von Steuben is a more complicated case. The one bit of documentary possible evidence we have is a letter that was written about him by a prospective employer back in Germany, and inquired of a former employer, is it true? There are rumors that von Steuben has taken familiarities with young boys. So this is going beyond gay. This is getting into pedophilia. Now, he asked this very skeptically. He asked this in a tone of people are saying this. I don't think this is true. Please, you know, confirm or deny. And he seems to be expecting a denial from the tone of the letter. We don't have a reply. Von Steuben resumed contact with the former employer, which suggests there wouldn't have been anything amiss going on. This came to Washington's attention after von Steuben was over here, and someone somehow, I forget if it was an American or a European, I think it must have been an American, had found out about this, brought this to Washington's attention, and Washington just dismissed it, because von Steuben's value to him had been so proven that he wasn't interested in it. Also, I think he correctly saw this as just European gossip. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, von Steuben never married, very devoted younger aides who lived with him and cared for him in his old age.
What I think is fascinating is that we can't even predict what they would do in their lifetime. If you ask most people in 1776, 78, something like that, which Southerner, Thomas Jefferson or George Washington, would be more likely to become a critic of slavery and do something substantive about slavery? Jefferson was an outspoken critic. He said many things when he was a young man, and he said less and less about slavery the older he got, virtually nothing. While he's president, he won't recognize Toussaint Louverture, even though he is a leader of an independence movement. What about George Washington? George Washington is relying on slaves to maintain this incredible presence in Virginia society. He has his slaves in livery. He's has carriages coming from London. He's very much making his place in this planter society. But when he becomes head of the Continental Army, he finds blacks fighting in units in Massachusetts, and he's quite impressed by their valor. This is just dumbfounding to him. But he continues to act like a typical planter, seeking to recover slaves that ran away when they came north. But over the years, and as death approached, once in an earlier illness, and then his last year, he decides to free his slaves in his will. Martha Washington and all of his descendants are furious with him, and yet he took that stand and freed his slaves because he had come to see that slavery was an immoral, unjust institution. Now, I don't think anyone, through observing those two men through their lifetime, would have predicted this switch That's why I think it's extremely difficult for us to predict how they would respond to situations that are utterly novel to them.
You said do something substantive. That's the key. That would always mean George Washington would be the one to do that rather than Thomas Jefferson. Now let's take a little dig against Jefferson there. Any questions?
He's a lot of fun.
Yes, sir.
Well, in addition to Darfur, we also have the situation in Iraq. And while it's pretty hard to know what even people who served in the previous administration might do, what can you say about the Founding Fathers in terms of the concept of getting involved in situations that might be threatening to the United States on a preemptive basis?
Okay, preemptive war. I don't think that's something they never thought about. Any thoughts on that? I mean, it does come up, doesn't it come up at least as a possibility in the whole question of Louisiana before Jefferson finally buys it?
Well, Hamilton is interested in taking Louisiana. He prefers to take it than to buy it.
Rather than to buy it.
Right, right. I mean, I would say that the preemptive war is one that we never recognized in American history, which would be the war against the indigenous population that were moving into their territories. And there were lots of preemptive strikes, but they were done informally and not by a United States Army, though often the United States Army helped settlers. But I'm not going to predict what they would do about Iraq because I don't know.
Well, the part of the Iraq situation, I think one can say something about, although we will no doubt disagree on this. And that is I don't think anyone of the revolutionary generation would have made the assumption that if you took a dictator out, democracy would happen like weeds sprouting on a newly plowed field. They understood well that democracy was an achievement and that it had to come from below. Actually, this is what Madeleine Albright has been saying, and I think in that regard there was an understanding for the achievement that is democracy. The idea that it simply happened as a residual is demeaning to democracy. And I have no idea if the administration really thought that, how anyone of any respect for the institutions we have could have held that assumption.
Pauline, do you think among the founders there was a spectrum on this very question of those who were more and less hopeful of democracy, both at home and then also in other countries, the main one being France?
I use the word democracy as we use it, not as they used it. I mean, obviously, democracy was a contested issue then. For us, any government, I think, that is founded on popular consent is democratic. And I suppose if you use the roots of it, that's some justification for that. But they distinguish republics from democracy. And certainly there was, because I think of the British background, there remained a certain understanding of the utility of monarchy in some situations. And certainly tremendous respect from their understanding of history of the volatility of governments that were based on popular consent. I mean, one of the reasons for the Constitution was that the uprisings in Massachusetts and in New Hampshire and the sense of popular discontent everywhere was going to signal the end of the republic. As in Rome, as in the end of the British Commonwealth. And if you're going to look forward, of course, mm-hmm. The failure of the French Republic and the rise of Napoleon. They sort of feared that was happening in the United States in the late 1780s. So there's a, yes, they're committed to making the Republic work, but there is very little sort of romantic feelings about democracy.
And yet the pattern in America has been to applaud revolutions when they begin and then to become deeply disillusioned over time. And this has happened again and again and again in American history. What's remarkable, when the French Revolution erupts, originally there was universal support among Americans. It took a while before the Federalists began to look much more critically at what was occurring in France based on what events were occurring in France. But this pattern of enthusiasm followed by disillusionment is a deep
American pattern. This is the 150th anniversary of Freud's birth today, right? And Freud, whatever one thinks of him, teaches us about how the past haunts the present, how the past experience shapes the way we respond. And you can see patterns in societies just like we can see those neurotic patterns in those people we know, right?
Another question. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. I wonder if we could ask these founders, who are great leaders, who they think are the great leaders in the world today, and if they think they don't know of any great leaders, why they would think there is such a dearth of leadership.
I think what they had was political imagination, and that's what's lacking today. There seems to be a staleness about politics where there isn't a capacity to imagine a world which is rapidly becoming more and more intensely integrated and has all these new challenges. I think that just the communication that we're experiencing today makes us aware of so many abuses around the world that we simply didn't know about, and we don't really know how to respond to those abuses, and we don't have leaders. If I were, I guess, to pick any leader, it would be Nelson Mandela, simply because, but he's not a leader now, but I mean, in my lifetime, because he did have the imagination to imagine an entirely different society in South Africa, and that's what I would say is the factor that's missing. It's not that I think that they're cowardly, though I often think that, but I think it's that they are cowardly because they don't see a course of action in which they could be brave.
Well, can you imagine the city of Houston producing leaders like the founders? And that we had a country the size, with a population the size of Houston, right, that produced this incredible group of people, some of whom were college educated, but many of whom were not. I mean, this is truly extraordinary when one thinks about it. But I think that there are certain principles that we can see that they had that our leaders don't have. One is a combination of a commitment to principle combined with a commitment to realism. We often have people who articulate principles that are not matched by realism, or we have realists who are not matched by principle. And that combination is just absolutely crucial. Secondly, they believed in the power of moral influence. George Washington knew that his character mattered, that it would shape the way Americans thought about their government, and he had to behave accordingly. Eloquence was another element of their notion of leadership. We don't see much of any of these elements these days.
I was just wondering how the founding fathers would have a sense of accomplishment today with a highly politicized environment in which you can't get anything done on any reasonable basis, whereas the founding fathers operated in a fairyland of without constraints, really. There was no strong structure in which to constrain them. They were able to use their imagination and their learning and their creativity to create a country, whereas today, if they were to operate, there will be all kinds of constraints of them coming together. I'm not sure we know how capable some people are who were involved in this country. The best and the brightest don't get involved in the political process because of all kinds of reasons. And my question is, how comfortable would you be in accrediting the founding fathers with a job that they could do today? And how important was it at the time of the founding fathers that they had very little constraints and that they were able to evolve a country which wasn't the country and without the constraints of legislation and polarization of competing ideologies?
The Constitution was done rather rapidly, and sessions were in secret because they wanted to have as few constraints as possible, but they had an enormous constraint, which were powerful, independent states that had joined together under the Articles of Confederation that decreed each state to be sovereign and independent. And they had to vault over that constraint. I can't think of anything more. But what I think is interesting about the founders is they could deliberate during the Constitutional Convention. As long as they were founders, it was fine. When they became political leaders of parties, I agree with Rick, they were as angry, hostile a group as you could find. Men would cross the street who'd been former soldiers in arms, and they'd cross the street rather than to tip their hats to one of their political enemies. And this lasted for another 20 years. the doctors would say, I can't go to that town because the town can't afford two practices, and there's already a Federalist physician. I mean, so it was the society was permeated with partisan hostility for about 30 years.
David?
Well, just for the sake of argument, I'd almost make the case that that's what our political culture needs more of, real partisanship. Parties that actually stand for clear ideologies that mobilize electorates, that don't simply try to find small constituencies who are interested in one issue that you can divide people on, get them to the polls, but parties that actually really stand for traditions and ideologies that would inform our politics. We trust the system as long as it lasts. What we don't trust these days, I find this in my own students. Students will sit in the brightest kids in America will sit in my office and say to me, I don't like politics. And I'll say, well, what do you mean by that? Well, I don't like all that conflict. Well, why don't you like conflict? Well, it's just too partisan. And yet they're in my class where they're learning about how the Civil War came about. And yet they live in a culture where it's perfectly possible for them to live above all of this, next to all of this, beyond all of this. Now, I'm not suggesting we need to go back to
duels.
No, we don't need the code duello anymore, and we don't need name-calling of the kind. You're right, in the 1790s, the kind of brutal personalization of name-calling is extraordinary. But genuine partisanship is what a real democracy is about.
Steve? Let me play devil's advocate once again. We've all lived through a series of revolutions, despite all the stalemate in our politics, that are truly amazing. Look at the changes that have taken place in race in your lifetime. Look at the changes that have taken place in the status of women, roles of women in your lifetime. These are among the greatest revolutions in all of American history. They didn't take place so much in the halls of Congress, they took place in all of our individual lives. Because that's, I think, where the action really takes place. There's a kind of fundamental truth, I think, in social history, which argues that the decisions and actions of infinite numbers of ordinary people count more in the long run than what goes on in Washington. There's a wonderful book. I'm sure many of you have read it. I guess they're going to make a remake of the movie, but I can assure you they won't have this line in it. Many of you read All the King's Men by Robert Penn Warren. And it's wonderful for historians because it's about a history graduate student who observes this Huey Long character. And then at the very end of the book, he has a wonderful line that I think we should all carry with us. It's, out of history, into history, and the awesome responsibilities of time. That is, we should study history so it can inform us, so that we can go about the process of making the future, which is, of course, a blank page on which nothing has been written. Thank you, Steve. thank you all.
We're going on to our next event.